right. Hello, everyone. I will go around and say hello, starting with Darlene and Linda. Linda, I don't know your last name. There's two Lindas tonight, I think. What's your Linda's PC? What is your what is the first letter of your last name?
It's R.
R. All right. I'll try to remember that. Okay. Linda R. And Shane? Tyler? Bob K? Ellen? Paul? Jinryu? Catherine? Mark W? Although we haven't seen Mark C for a while. Sam? Susan? Franklin? Sydney? Grant? Good to see you. Amanda? Mick? Charles? Joan? Gaffel? Alice? John? Marv? Katie? Tessa? Sabrina? And Drew, or it looks like Drew's daughter, is the picture that we see. All right. Let's see. We do have, there's still a little bit of time to sign up for the term student program, but I should be clear that you need to have been regularly involved with the Sangha for several months at least before doing that. And it's not because I want to be exclusive at all, but just it really, what I've found is that if people haven't already established a regular practice with the Sangha, that they tend to do the first term student retreat and then disappear. I just kind of, it's almost like it's just too much. So like, let's just get established with the Sangha practice first and then add the term student retreat on. So we'll do that again in the fall too. So if anybody wants to participate in that, oh, let me turn my light up here. All right. I can't think of any other announcements. Anybody else think of something or have any questions about what's going on or anything like that? Okay. All right. Well, then tonight we'll get started on our foundational teachings class number 2. This class is on enlightenment, particularly because these are the foundational teachings. So it's not so much that this class is on enlightenment and what does it mean in all contexts, but more, you know, what was the Buddha's enlightenment, supposedly, right? 2,500 years ago. What did he wake up to? Why was it significant? So I'm going to tell the story of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, or perhaps more appropriately to say Siddhartha Gautama's enlightenment, because Siddhartha Gautama was the name of the man who practiced. And then Shakyamuni Buddha means a Buddha is an awakened being. And Shakyamuni is sage of the Shakya clan. So the Shakyamuni Buddha is like his post-enlightenment name. So, and then I'll talk a little bit about why what he awakened to was so important and why it's significant to us. But first I'm going to try something that I've never done before. some of the teachers online may have done this before, but I have not done a Zoom poll before. But I'm going to give you a poll, and there's 3 questions on it, and I'm hoping, you know, if you're on a phone or you're on a tablet, I don't know how well it's going to work. whatever. It's not that big a deal. It's an anonymous poll. So there's three questions and just multiple choice. And they have to do about enlightenment and kind of how do you think about it? What's your attitude about the concept of enlightenment? And then, but then we get to see the results. So it's anonymous, but then we get to see, you know, everybody's results. So I will share that poll and then give, I don't know, a minute. And go ahead, if you have any trouble accessing it, go ahead and unmute yourself or send me a chat or something. All right. So you should see a poll.
Interesting questions.
Cool. Anybody not finished? Okay. Cool. Question three isn't complete. Oh, what was it?
I assumed it was beings.
Huh. You can't see the whole sentence? Okay. It should be, do you think there are any enlightened people?
Yeah.
All right. I will end the polling and then I'll share the results. So we have some passionate, some inspired, most people said intrigued by the concept of enlightenment, couple ambivalent, couple skeptical. Makes sense. How relevant does the concept seem to your practice? Somewhat. There's some varies and extremelys, not very. Not sure. So interesting like spread in there. Do you think there are any enlightened people? Yes, definitely. One out. Probably, maybe no. Not sure. All right. Well, any reactions or questions or observations to the poll?
I had one, I guess. I always struggle with this idea of enlightenment as a state. Like, it doesn't seem like something that you get to, like you pass through a door and then you're just enlightened to me. But I could have a completely wrong understanding. I think it's more like an emotion almost, in the sense that they come and go. It comes and goes. So for me, the questions are almost kind of not relevant.
Interesting. Mick, were you going to say something?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I understand the idea of enlightenment, I think. But it's always seemed a little like, I know that in Mahayana, we have the Bodhisattva ideal, but enlightenment to me has always seemed this weird kind of like, I don't want to say self-centered, but that's sort of what I'm gravitating towards, like idea, like, you know, and I guess that's what attracts me to Mahayana is, I don't necessarily think of it as enlightenment, but I just want to understand how best to like help other people. And I mean, I guess enlightenment is ultimately understanding that, but I see it maybe as a little subtly different in some way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. What is enlightenment good for?
Well, I think once you become, I mean, I think kind of the path to enlightenment includes, you know, a deeper and deeper knowledge of self, but ultimately that leads to the knowledge or the understanding of the connectivity between ourselves and everything else. And so while perhaps at this point as unenlightened people, it is self-centered, but ultimately it is all-encompassing and very much directed toward others. Mm. And plus, you know, the one thing we also have is the Bodhisattva vow, which is part of our type of Zen, our type of worship and study. Mm-hmm. And that is directly related to others. And not, it's not about understanding or helping oneself, it's about helping others.
To study the self is to forget the self, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully that got the juices flowing a little bit. So I'll tell you a little bit about the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. Some of you will have been exposed to this already on the podcast episode recommended for this this class. But a little note on, I guess a little note on the historicity of the Buddha and his awakening and whatever, meaning, you know, historical accuracy or reality. Did this person really exist? And there are Buddhists, there are certainly Buddhists who believe everything very literally. So, you know, that X number of years ago, and there was a guy, and he, on one night, he sat down and he had this amazing experience and he had this incredible insight. And for the rest of his life, he was next to omniscient. So, I mean, there are Buddhists who believe that. From my point of view, anyway, which I feel is pretty consistent with our lineage, it really doesn't matter whether Shakyamuni Buddha ever existed. I mean, I guess it's a little inspiring to think that he did, but whether one person created the path of practice that we follow, or it evolved out of a bunch of people or over time or something, you know, what really matters is this path of practice works, that we try it and we find it rewarding and it works. So kind of who cares where it came from is my thinking anyway. And in terms of exactly his, you know, Shakyamuni's or Siddhartha's process of, you know, working toward awakening and exactly what he experienced and saw, I mean, you know, we have no idea. These are scriptures from thousands of years ago that were orally transmitted and written down on palm leaves and lost and found again and all this stuff. So really, I think it's most useful to look at this stuff as mythology in the good sense, you know, in the sense that what matters is this is the story of our tradition, and it conveys something. There's some truth in it, even if it is not perhaps historically real. So that's what we can look at in terms of this story of the Buddha's enlightenment. I'm guessing it didn't happen on one night. That sounds pretty remarkable, right? But it kind of, for dramatic purposes, you might as well say, you know, it happened on one evening, right? He sat through the night, and then when he saw the morning star, it all kind of clicked. So I'm going to share just a little bit from the Pali Canon. Oh, before I do that, actually, let me set a little bit of a context. So the Buddha, Buddhism arose at a time in India where there was all kinds of change and all kinds of new religious innovations going on. So Buddhism was just one of many religions and spiritual traditions that arose at the time, including Jainism, which still exists, and, you know, new innovations in the Vedic traditions and, you know, traditions that didn't survive and all that. So there was social change going on that made people really question the status quo and try new things. So the big question on everybody's mind was the idea of rebirth. So this doctrine of transmigration had arisen 200 or 300 years before the Buddha, and it had spread widely. And the theory is that the Indians ended up having doing some astronomy at this time, and they began to appreciate the scale of the universe and to notice the cycles, to notice the vast cycles of the time and the constellations and what have you. So they ended up getting this sense that time, you know, was very vast, that there were large cycles. And therefore they began to conceive of this world being like you would be reborn again, right? So you live out your life. At the end of your life, somehow some aspect of you, there's a little in between time, and it goes and inhabits a new, you know, sperm and egg come together, and bam, you go like jump inside it, right? And then you're reborn. And then there was conceived that there were six different realms of existence. So this isn't just limited to Buddhism either, but there's a particular Buddhist take on it. And there was the human realm, which is kind of a mixed bag, you know, sometimes great, sometimes really sad. There was a heaven realm, a hell realm. You can imagine what those are. A hungry ghost realm, where you're never satisfied, you're constantly seeking. There was a beast realm, where you're just concerned with just the basics of life and very self-absorbed. A fighting demon realm, where you're just very envious of what they have in the heaven realm. And the idea was that you, during this rebirth, you could take rebirth in any one of these realms. So there was this big question of like, why do you get reborn in a particular realm? And what can you do in this lifetime to like increase your chances of a good rebirth? And of course, even within just like, even if you're not imagining other realms, even within the human realm, there are different kinds of rebirth, right? Some people are born very fortunate in very fortunate circumstances, or they're very smart, or they're very beautiful, or they're very skilled or something. And some of us are just, you know, unlucky. So why does this happen? And so there were all kinds of different theories. One said you couldn't do anything about it. It was all just fate or chance. There were the Vedic traditions tended to be more like, so if you're born into a particular caste, you have certain duties to fulfill. And if you fulfill them, particularly like ceremonial duties and things like that, that's what buys you a better rebirth next time. So you kind of just, you know, suck it up this time around and do what you're supposed to do. And then you might be able to, if you follow these rules, then you get yourself a better rebirth. And then the Jainism had another theory entirely about karma being some kind of sticky substance that's attached to your soul, and there's certain practices that purify that your being of that. I don't mean to, you know, speak lightly of it. There's more to it than that. But so there were all these theories about what is this life about, and why do we experience what we do? Why sometimes are things go great and sometimes they're terrible? You know, if tomorrow any one of us is hit by tragedy, You know, why does that happen? It almost inevitably, no matter what our beliefs are, some part of us is going to go kind of like, you know, why did this happen now? Why did this happen to me? Is there something that I did to bring it on? Is there something I could have done to prevent it, et cetera? So this is the background of the Buddha's search. He's looking to see, you know, are we just doomed essentially to be happy when things are going well, good fortune, good health, you know, financial security, whatever, then we're great. But eventually things change and then we're miserable. So it's like, is that our lot? Is there anything else that we can do about that? So he went on his spiritual search, which I won't go into here, but he's got a nice story of how he went about that. But as finally he's happened upon a great form of meditation, his mind is very still and concentrated. And he says he then directed it to the knowledge of recollecting his past lives. This is the traditional, this is the mythology, right? So he recollected just countless past lives. If you can kind of imagine being able to look back over your past lives. And he said, I saw that I was born here and I had these circumstances. I belonged to this clan and had that life. And then this happened and then that happened. And so he sees just life after life, this unfolding of causes and conditions. And then his view expanded and he was able to see the past lives of other beings as well. And he says, I discerned how beings are inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, in accordance with their karma. These beings who were endowed with bad conduct of body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, held wrong views, and undertook actions under the influence of wrong views, with the breakup of the body, after death, have reappeared in the plane of deprivation, the bad destination, the lower realms in hell. But these beings who are endowed with good conduct of body, speech, and mind, who do not revile the noble ones, who held right views and undertook actions under the influence of right views, with the breakup of the body after death, have reappeared in the good destinations in the heavenly world. So he sees this playing out of karmic conditions and sees, you know, people do this, then they're reborn like this, then if this happens, they do this, then this happens. So the good thing is that we don't have to see past lives. We don't even have to believe in past lives, right? This is the mythology anyway of what he sees. So you can just imagine. But the most important thing was then the Buddha used his own mind as a laboratory. This is the words of Tanisa Robiku, which I liked. He used his own mind as a laboratory. And he observed directly in his own mind. Now, so he had looked out, you know, kind of over time and space, right? Then he's looking in his own mind and he's seeing how here's dukkha or dissatisfactoriness or stress. Here it is. When this arises, dukkha arises. When this doesn't arise, dukkha doesn't arise. So it's like he's making like these scientific observations of his own experience. So he ends up seeing the origin, the cause of dissatisfaction. And it's caused by this. Now, what about that? Can we do anything about that cause? And then he said, yes, we can do something about that cause. We can let that go. What's caused, oftentimes it's translated as desire, but essentially it's, you know, it's resistance. It's not wanting things to be the way they are. Namely, and I'll talk of this will be the next class, namely, they're impermanent, ungraspable, they have no inherent self nature, and therefore they're dissatisfactory. So one of my teachers, Kyogen, liked to explain, like, this is the nature of life, of our existence. Even if you had, he said, if you had the most comfortable chair ever, like you shopped around and for the most comfy, easy chair, and just, oh, it was so comfy. Said, now it's comfortable for an hour or 2 hours, maybe 6 hours. If you had to stay in the chair for 12 hours or 24 or 8 days straight, I mean, eventually, like, it's not comfortable anymore, right? Nothing is permanently satisfying in that sense. So we resist that. We don't like that. So what is the significance of this realization of the Buddha? What's important here? Now, to go back a little bit to what he said he noticed, you know, as he's looking out at beings, he noticed they held wrong views, and then they undertook actions with the influence of wrong views, or they had right views. And by wrong and right in this case, it's not a moral judgment. It's more like, if you talk about, that's the right key for that door. That's the key that works. that's the right key. So that's how we should think about this. Like, the right views are like consistent with reality. Wrong views are not. So what he noticed was the importance of these behavior was important, but it was incredibly influenced by the views that the beings had, by the understanding they had about the world and their relationship to it. And in particular, right view, the view that is consistent with reality and which works and which relieves us from suffering, is seeing what he saw, was seeing that, you know, dissatisfactoriness arises because we wish things to be other than how they are. We can let go of that wish, and then dukkha disappears. And he also saw a whole path of practice for us to make that happen. So that's the practice aspect of it, the Eightfold Path, which we'll also be talking about. So one of my favorite scholars, Ajahn Tanisaro, he's pointed out that this led Siddhartha to consider the possibility that karma, so the karma is the what impacts your experience, what impacts your rebirth, or if you prefer, what impacts the experience you're going to have next week or next year or throughout your life, whether you are happy or miserable. He's considered the possibility that karma was primarily a mental process rather than a physical one. So I don't know if you've ever heard this analogy, but Buddhism has been likened to, rather than, so if you're in bare feet and there's sharp stones on the ground, rather than covering the earth in leather, you cover your feet. So there's only so much we can do about our circumstances. Things are impermanent. Things are ungraspable. Things will ultimately be dissatisfying in any kind of sensual way. So that's uncomfortable. But we can do something in our own mind and our own behavior to change our experience. So it's not entirely mind over matter, right? It's not denying that we might get sick or that we might die or anything like that. But it is saying that we can have a huge influence on our own experience. Or as I like to phrase it, our experience of the world is profoundly affected by the state of our own mind, about how we see things, how we understand our relationship to things. So a a lot of our negative behaviors are driven by wrong views, right? We think that we are separate from beings and we need to protect ourselves and get our own. And in doing so, we end up creating suffering for self and other. Whereas, as people were talking about, if we awaken in some ways to our lack of separation from people, beings, life, compassion flows, less self-absorption results. So, I wanted to, briefly talk about the nature of enlightenment. So we talked a little bit about this from people's responses to the poll, where, you know, is enlightenment this, you know, all or nothing thing, which I would say not, but there can be dramatic experiences of, I would say, essentially a shift in understanding. You know, it can be, you can have small shifts in understanding, or you can have massive shifts in understanding and realize, oh my Lord, you know, that things aren't at all how I thought they were. So those massive shifts in understanding are what we might point to for some folks as enlightenment experiences or awakening experiences. But I thought it was interesting also to just explore a little bit this term enlightenment, which obviously that's an English term. That wasn't the original Buddhist term. And I don't know that much about the original Pali terms, but they're more often translated as awakening or liberation. So enlightenment, there's some good things about using that term because, so enlightenment in the West is associated with like an intellectual and philosophical movement, right? It's like, you know, reason over faith and, you know, the scientific method and ideals such as liberty, progress, toleration, fraternity, constitutional government, you know, enlightenment. So it's a set of ideals. It's being smart and rational. And to some extent, it's not a bad term because it emphasizes the importance of the evidence of the senses, which is something consistent with, you know, this idea of awakening to like the Buddha, his real awakening was in this direct experience, his own direct experience, seeing what was true. But then also along with enlightenment, you got this sense of intellect, it's an intellectual thing, or it's a set of ideals or behaviors that you might believe in. Whereas the term awakening, it's like waking up from a delusion as opposed to acquiring any new ideas or adopting some new philosophy. You're awakening from delusion. And liberated, this is probably liberation is the most common translation. That's the important part, right? In a way, it doesn't matter what you believe. It's, you know, what is the impact of that belief? What is the impact of that new understanding? What is the impact in that of that shift? So I think it's helpful to not view enlightenment in a dualistic binary way, but as more of an opening up, you know, a deepening of intimacy, a widening of perspective, increasing willingness to let go of our mental map of reality, a growing familiarity with things as it is. So my teacher Kyogen talked about a lotus blossom gradually opening. You know, that some people perhaps, and oftentimes if people are really kind of stuck emotionally or intellectually, the shift in perspective might be a baha, you know. But more often it's just, you know, a little petal at a time just opens up, and pretty soon you have an open blossom. Or you get wet from walking in the mist. You know, you don't recognize so much that things are changing, but eventually, oh, you're wet. So I wanted to do a breakout where I ask folks to create a list of enlightenments. So defining enlightenment, and I will share a document where this definition is for anybody who can pull it up and keep it, as an insight into your own mind or behavior that results in a relief of suffering for self or other. So an insight into your own mind or behavior that results in a relief of suffering for self or other. So it's not so much a insight into, you know, I realized what was wrong with my car and I was able to go out and fix it and now it's not broken anymore. But this is about what, you know, some shift in our own understanding or our own behavior that actually makes the situation better without necessarily anything changing in the situation at all. I mean, maybe sometimes something in the situation then shifts because we're not causing problems anymore, or we're not fighting it anymore. But in a way, the shift in our understanding and behavior comes first. So let me share. I'm not sure if this will go away once you go into breakout rooms. I don't think so. Well, probably. I can also put it in the chat. And some people can see the chat when they go into a breakout room and some people can't. So hopefully somebody in your room will be able to see this. Or you can write it down. An insight into your own mind or behavior that results in a relief of suffering for self and other. So what I'm thinking of is a list. And if you wouldn't mind having a secretary of sorts to report back a few of your ideas, you know, not just thinking in terms of this, you know, the Buddhist enlightenment, although you might include something like that. These can be small things that happen over the course of the day. These can be, you know, shifts in your life, times when you have, you know, it's really, you realize how you could relate to things differently. You could behave fundamentally differently. A different option opens up and ends up working a whole lot better than what you were doing before. So with that, I will recreate.
Which is part of Cedar Mill.
Huh? Okay.
We used to live in Cedar Hills.
All right. Well, let me share my little document here, and please speak up and let me know some of your ideas, some of the stuff that either you thought of or shared or somebody else did. Enlightenments. I never really thought of putting it this way before, but...
Well, I can rattle off a few of ours.
All right.
The present moment is not about me. using nonviolent communication with children.
What is the insight there?
Sorry, that was mine. It was just, I've worked with kids all my life. And then a number of years ago, I learned about this. I learned about nonviolent communication specifically in working with children. And it just completely changed how I worked, like how I completely changed how I work with kids and how I interact with them and how my relationships with them and everything. So it was just it relieved a lot of suffering for me, but I think also, you know, for working with kids in that way, using that language is really liberating for them and help, you know. Yeah, don't know if that's enough information or what else you would.
Yeah, no, that's great. Just want to know a little bit more about the experience there.
I think in our group, we had a couple, and a lot of them kind of like boiled down to kind of like understanding the nature of a relationship between people, or really understanding someone else's perspective. You know, we had somebody talk about their family relationships, and somebody talk about professional relationships, and sort of how, like, if you really can understand, you know, what it looks like from someone else's perspective, or really what's going on, that it changes a lot of the way that you can approach that relationship. I thought that was really neat.
One of ours was, we give people to care about the people we care about the thing we value the most, whether they appreciate it or not.
In our group, I guess one of the insights was compassion instead of judgment is kind of a universal suffering reducer, suffering reduction technique. And also that someone said that angry reactions create sort of contagion, like a contagion of anger or a cycle of anger.
Pressing a longer statement down into one sentence, that there is a bigger world outside of our tribe.
At some point, an important insight in my practice was a lot of suffering is relieved if you're not so scared of death. one of the things that I used to be, you know, I still don't really like flying, you know, just like, and mostly because I didn't want to end up the last few minutes of my life like, like in complete terror, like. But at some point I just kind of realized, well, so the last few minutes of my life would be in complete terror. I mean, it's not like that invalidated, you know, everything that came before. It's just what it just would be what it is. So kind of letting go of that fear of that terror or that potential death, like, was just like, I don't know.
Well, I'm like Gathel, I'm afraid to reduce down these meaningful comments people made in my group, but one of them was, I'm sorry, let you finish typing, Domi, I'm sorry.
All right.
Sorry about that. Well, one of our comments had to do with letting go of expectations of how what people should be to us, specifically parents. I'll just sort of repeat what the person said, specifically parents, and being able to see them for who they are and what they do have. And then there was another really cool comment about how, like, awareness of the way mental resistance to something irritating or someone irritating, you can feel that in your body. And then that helps you say, oh, I can release this bodily tension and let go of feeling irritated about that person or that event, which I thought was cool. And then, for me personally, I feel like practice kind of expands my comfort zone. So I just don't feel like it helps us feel not irritated in the first place by things we might have felt irritated by last year or last month. So for me, that relieves suffering, I feel, because it makes me a more receptive listener, because people can just be how they are.
We also had the idea that like self-knowledge, knowledge of what your tendencies are can prevent constant pain, learning your patterns of behavior and maybe accepting them as well.
I noticed that when I would erupt in my embarrassing little moments of rage about something silly, it was like there's a reaction, and there's a reaction to reaction, and a reaction to react, and it just like then it reverberates throughout the whole day, as opposed to well, there I go again. And it can just disappear, just, in the next moment. So these are all just, this is what I feel like we are going for in practice. So in a way, we practice for enlightenment. Now, there's a whole nother level Dogen talks about with practice and enlightenment are the same thing, right? But in this case, so we're practicing for enlightenment. But it's not just one big thing. It feels like this is the pivotal difference, I feel like, between people of practice, which certainly I've met people of practice who aren't necessarily Buddhist, but they usually do identify as having some kind of spiritual or religious path, because they are, when they encounter things in life, it's not just about whether they like that or not, or whether there's anything they can do to improve the situation. There's always this reflection on what might be I be able to do in my own body and mind to relieve some of the suffering that this situation is causing myself and others. So it's really like, what is it that I can let go of? What is it that I can work on? What is it that I can see or change? So with that, I will just say our closing verse, because it's 9:00. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Damiel.
Thank you.